Good evening. I thought I would start out with a little gift to the hosts. It is about an incident which, in retrospect, can be taken as an example for the complete failure of a marketing strategy. But it may also have contributed to the fact that Charles I not only lost his kingdom, but also his life. It concerns soap. Until the beginning of the 17th century, soap in England has been produced from the oil of whales or of fish. But in 1631, the king granted a patent, in other words, a monopoly, to some of the Catholic friends of his queen, permitting them to produce soap from the lard of pigs. To grant monopolies to members of the court in order to secure their support was a common practice of governments at the time. It was also a means to generate income for the crown. Of course, these pre-capitalist monopolies could not guarantee profit, but they could ban or at least hinder competition. In the case of the Catholic soap, this hindrance was brought about by ordering the Royal Navy to stop any ship that was used to bring in the unlawful oil for Protestant soap. The potential of using violence was always part and parcel of pre-capitalist monopolies. After 1631, former soap producers had to either buy their raw material from smugglers, to abandon their trade, or to acquiesce in the new form of production and patronage. They did not like any of these alternatives. Protestants claimed that the new product was just as unclean as the impure belief of the Catholic monopolists, and housewives protested that the soap was no good. To overcome resistance, the government decided on the organization of two advertising events, the first one in the Guildhall of London. Under the eyes of the Lord Mayor and eight ladies, two washerwomen demonstrated publicly that the new soap was not only just as good as the old one, but even better. A second event took place in Bristol, also to no avail. In 1637, this privilege was withdrawn, too late to change the negative public opinion of the reign. One of the lasting results of the English Revolution was the abolition of the government's competence to grant monopolies, thereby creating capitalist competition. But this decision was not extended to the international market. For almost two more centuries, the English Parliament decided to prolong monopolies in foreign trade. The use of military violence in order to attain and to safeguard trading monopolies in overseas strongholds was continued. And indeed, I hope you will accept another historical aside, the strife for monopolies and hence the continuous use of violence marks one of the most noteworthy differences between the first world market and the world market which started in the course of the 16th century, because Pace Emanuel Wallerstein, there had already been a world market in the 13th and the 14th century. It had combined European towns with towns in Arabia and Asia. Its participants had not been saints, but the continuous practice of robbery and piracy, which was to characterize the competition between European powers in the centuries to come, was not yet present. So-called guardsmen were paid to secure the peace on the Silk Roads. They would never have achieved anything if merchants had contended for monopolies. This world market dwindled away under the onslaught of the plague, which decimated the populations of the major trading towns. One can only guess how it would otherwise have continued, because it already suffered from the imbalance between offer and demand, which was to become decisive for the later development of Asian European trade. While European merchants sought spices, textiles, gems, and sometimes slaves, the partners were not keen on European wares, hence most often demanded to be paid in silver. In order to counteract this problem, many European merchants sought to make quick profits by robbing the ships of Indian or Arabian merchants, as well as the ships of European competitors sailing back home. Such preference for quick profit over long-standing and peaceful trading connections marked the new phase in long-distance trading. And these violent practices of competition were condoned by the European princes who, from the 16th century onwards, were more and more interested in the possibility of profits from long-distance trade. Not only the establishment of fortified trading strongholds, but even the strategies of establishing domination over the riches and populations in faraway regions of the world were prompted by endeavors to keep out European competitors. Contrary to widely held opinion, the development of long-distance trade did not mark the advent of capitalism. Huge profit was possible. It was based on the difference between purchase and sale, and more often than not, on outright robbery. And, contrary to another widely held opinion, the merchants participating in this trade were no capitalists in spe. They had no interest of having the privileges abolished on which their economic position was based, and they usually invested their gains in the social ascent of their families, buying letters of nobility where those were to be had, or property of land where that promised the integration in genteel society. The transformation of rich merchants into potential capitalists required the revolution of their mental outlook, hence a fundamental change of society. We should beware of explaining the birth of capitalism as resulting out of long-distance trade, but problems are also involved in the analytical concept of so-called primitive accumulation. Marx, Engels, and many Marxists assumed that capitalism became dominant once most members of the potential labor force were not only bereft of their autonomous possibilities to material reproduction, but had also become legally free to sell their capacity to labor. This has been proved erroneous by the real history of capitalism. From its early phases until our time, forced labor has been constantly made use of in capitalist production. And this is not only true for the fringes of capitalism, but it was and is also true for the metropolitan core of capitalism. I will go into this in greater length on Sunday. Today, I want to rather concentrate on the tendency of historians of capitalism, be they Marxist or not, to focus on national or, at best, Western developments. Despite the fact that the international character of capitalism is stated once and again, the organization of production in colonies has, and most often still is, treated as having served core capitalism, but not as really forming an integral part of the emerging capitalist world order. In short, if we accept that capitalism was international from its very beginning, and if we also accept that the use of forced labor is not enough to mark a certain organization as being pre-capitalist, then it becomes much more difficult to decide on the beginning of capitalism in a certain part of the world. I will try to explain this by focusing on two well-known historical trade circles, both of them centering on English practice. The first one concerns the production and the sale of opium, the second the production and the sale of sugar. In both cases, we have to restrict ourselves to a very rough outline. When the East India Company started to embroil itself in the ongoing power struggle among Indian princes in the 18th century, some of its shareholders in London remarked that this was too risky. But the necessity of making profits in order to be able to pay dividends compelled those who were responsible on the spot to not only fight competition, but to also look for income outside of trade. The company's trade simply was not profitable enough to finance its defense and its administration, as well as to pay dividends. At first, the East India Company tried to solve this problem by offering its military potential. It's a very modern sort of marketing, i.e. the soldiers as well as weapons to the different Indian princes fighting for dominance in India. But at the end of the 18th century, the company became itself a participant in the regional power struggle. Securing the conquest of Bengal, it appropriated the former rulers' competence to collect taxes. This alleviated the financial problems, but it did not change the fact that trade was hardly profitable because, just as centuries ago, Asian rulers and Asian populations simply were not interested in European commodities. On the other hand, Europeans were interested in Asian products, especially tea. And here we stumble on another advertising event that went wrong. After an English ship loaded with a large variety of European products had arrived in China in 1793, the Chinese emperor sent a letter to the English king telling him that, as his ambassador already knew, we have everything. In order to pay for tea without needing to have recourse to the limited stock of silver, the East India Company offered Indian products instead of European ones to China, amongst them corn, saltpeter, weapons, silk, and opium. Already at the end of the 18th century, one-third of this growing volume of regional Asian trade consisted of trade in opium. China decreed prohibitions. The trade continued through smuggle. In Bengal, farmers produced more and more opium, thereby increasing the risk of nutrition crisis. This first phase of the opium trade was not yet capitalist. Its participants were Indian farmers, hoping for an increase of income, privately trading clerks of the company, European and Indian ship owners, Chinese smugglers, and Chinese merchants. But then developments in Europe affected the integration of the opium trade into the capitalist world market. In the 18th century, more than 10% of the labor force of Bengal had been engaged in the production of textiles. A large part of this production had been exported to England because at this time English textile production could not yet compete with these imports. During the war against Napoleon, the French blockade hindered Indian imports. This slump might have been overcome after the war, but even before the war, English producers had started to mechanize their production processes in order to cheaply produce the checkered material which was used to pay for slaves in Africa. During the war, this mechanization expanded, thereby cheapening textiles. Since during the war, the need for uniforms offered vast possibilities, at the end of the war, English producers lost this demand. They started to agitate against Indian imports. At the same time, they increased their own exports to India. Having become cheaper, they were now able to successfully compete. The textile production in India slumped. Merchants in India wanting to buy the imported textile in order to sell them in India needed money. The sale of opium in China offered itself as a possibility to gain the means for this trade. Smuggle increased, and negotiations about the legal importation of opium to China failed. In 1833, advocates of free trade back home achieved the abolishment of the trading privileges of the East India Company. Now everybody could legally participate in Asian trade and smuggle. The success of this policy was demonstrated immediately. Already 1 year later, the amount of tea that was imported into England was 4 times as high as before the liberalization. And since the smuggling of opium had steadily increased, the profits from this trade had become more than sufficient to pay for the tea that was to be imported into England. Premier Palmerston advised the superintendent of trade in India to avoid any measure that could be interpreted as an attack by Chinese officials, while at the same time not assuming more authority over English subjects, as was absolutely necessary. In other words, free trade, in this case smuggling, was not to be disturbed. In order to not only secretly but also openly profit from the trade, the company demanded the opening of Chinese ports for the legal importation of opium into China. When this was refused, war was started. During the Second Opium War, it lasted from 1856 to 1860, the Chinese government was forced to agree to a contract which legalized the importation of opium. Not only in China, but also in England, merchants marketed successfully the drug. In the middle of the 19th century, the number of drug addicts amongst English workers, amongst workers in English industrial plants, is reported to have been very high. To resume, from a regional trade which developed in a pre-capitalist economic and political environment, the trade in opium developed into an element of global capitalist relations. And this trade had no resemblance whatsoever with the pacifying and civilizing influence which theoreticians of the 18th century had expected of the extension of trade relations. My second example concerns sugar. Its production by slaves in British West India has been the subject of the famous Williams hypothesis. According to Eric Williams, he has been Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago between 1956 and 1981. The profits from the slave trade and from the marketing of sugar, which had been produced by slaves, helped to finance industrialization in England. He assumed that the same relation held true for the French sugar colonies. Once industrialization had effectively got on its way, the triangular trade between Africa, West India, and England was no longer necessary. Hence, the tariff privileges for the sugar producers were abolished. This helped abolitionists to finally achieve the prohibition of slavery. This hypothesis has been widely discussed, most of the participants focusing on profits. We do not have to go into this because it has already been mentioned that profits in colonial production were not, as a matter of fact, automatically transferred into industry. Joseph Inikori has found evidence that before the definite development of banking, quite large sums of money may have simply been hoarded. One might add that according to Kenneth Pomerantz, the amount of capital needed for starting industrial production was rather limited, and that in any case, the mining of coal in England itself was much more important for this development. And Richard Sheridan resumed that industrialization came about, I cite, chiefly from without within. Nevertheless, some productions have definitely been furthered by the trade in slave. The extensive production of chains and iron collars in Liverpool, for example, would otherwise not have found its market. Nor would the shipyards have been quite as busy. But it was not any squeeze of profits which produced the first very severe crisis in the English sugar-producing colonies, but the war of independence being fought by the North American colonies. The sugar colonies depended on the importation of foodstuff from the North American colonies. When this more or less stopped because the Royal Navy was effectively blocking the trade of the northern colonies during the war, thousands of slaves died because of undernourishment. That, in spite of this crisis, planters were eager to buy new slaves is explained by the growing market for sugar in England. There, the consumption of sugar had risen very quickly in the course of the 18th century by the fact that, unlike as in India, it became customary in the English gentility to put sugar in one's tea. While coffee was typically consumed in coffee houses, tea was mostly consumed at home. When prices began to fall at the end of the 18th century, the middle classes also could afford to drink tea with sugar. According to Ralph Austin and Woodruff Smith, this consummation became a mark of respectability. Prices had fallen because at the time, consummation grew slower than the production. In spite of the fact that the demand for sugar was still mostly concentrated in London, it fueled the demand for slaves in West India. Of course, the demand for tobacco, rice, and indigo had the same effect. But not only were planters eager to replace slaves, but they also started to order more and more industrial products from the mother country, thereby furthering industrialization. Even if emancipation was only gradually put into effect in the different sugar colonies, planters were looking out for ersatz. From the 1840s onward, more and more coolies were imported, not exclusively, but mostly from East Asia. And by the end of the 19th century, the trade in workers' contracts, because it certainly was a trade, was flourishing. Some of these contract workers had decided to try their luck abroad and had entered their contracts of their own free will, but very many of them were put on ships by deception or through outright abduction. The recruitment as well as the production process was still ripe with violence. The end of the tariff production of colonial sugar in 1846 and the starting competition of beet sugar did not help to alleviate the burden of coolies. Unlike trade in opium, trade in sugar had, from the very first, developed in a capitalist development. The slaves who were used for its production were recruited by sheer force through African and European slave traders. The labor on plantations was hard and it was forced. The same held true for the contract workers who replaced them. But not only was this forced labor directly interwoven with developments in the metropolitan core of capitalism, it was also part and parcel of capitalist labor regimes. This pattern of interconnectedness of forced labor, international trade relations, and consumer practices has remained characteristic for capitalism. I am not going to debate if it has increased in our times or not, but simply state that it is still present. Since many endeavor now to make it public, we are finally coming to understand that all those men, women, and children who are producing commodities for the world market in any part of the world are part of the capitalist labor force tout court. Many elements of capitalism have changed, but some have not changed so very much. There are, for example, new forms of triangle trades. Women to be forced into sex work are often recruited by the deceptive offer of regular wage labor. But there also exists forceful recruitment for the trade in women and children as sexual objects. Some international criminal organizations exchange these human commodities for drugs and then exchange drugs for weapons. Outright slavery still exists, even if today most slaves are no longer bought and sold, and even if their owners are often able to show some sort of faked contract. These modern-day slaves are dumped as soon as economic conjuncture or bodily weakness renders them useless. But slave-like conditions of labor can also be achieved by more or less legal methods. The huge business of contracting laborers for foreign workplaces not only enriches the sellers of these contracts, but also the employers of foreign workers, making use of the opportunity to pay these laborers hardly anything, housing them under conditions of which they must hope that they remain unknown to the wider public. This not only happens in Arabian countries or in Russia, but also in the metropolitan capitalist countries. In Germany, the most notorious labor conditions for foreign workers concern butchers from East Europe. And once again, consumer practices do make a difference. The working conditions of foreign butchers are directly related to the expectation that meat is to be had very cheaply. Of course, these expectations are constantly nourished by the advertisements of the big chains, explaining that very good meat can be had for almost no money. Not only many of these butchers, but also foreign workers engaged by a world-famous shipyard in Germany had to hand in their passports to their employer, which means that they were deprived of any legal possibility to leave. It is this prevention of leave which, in my opinion, defines modern slavery. In this case, the company had to change its practice after the death of three foreign workers in a fire which had broken out in one of the densely packed living quarters. Sometimes workers are not prevented to enter contract, but to leave their workplace during working hours. We all know about the relation between the death toll of fires and working conditions in the textile industry of Bangladesh and elsewhere. And we also know that these working conditions are sustained by international practices of consummation. They have not changed after the sheer number of deaths during a fire in November 2012 has for once made it into the international headlines. In October 2013, last month, the government of Bangladesh and the International Labour Organization have launched an initiative to improve labour conditions. One can only hope that it will make a change, but until now, the caravan of the ready-made garment sector has usually reacted to the threat of improved control and demands of higher wages by simply moving on to another country. This mobility, even if it is only easy manageable for some production processes, constitutes one of the differences to early phases of capitalism. Capital has long been mobile, neither restricted to a certain nation state nor to its colonies. But the ready-made offer of cheap wage labor is a relatively new phenomenon. We all know of many examples for the integration of horrible labor conditions into relations of international trade and consumer practices. There's no need of enumeration. We may, however, pause to remark that these relations are not so very dissimilar to those of the sugar-slave relations, which has been mentioned. But our times are also ripe with the invention of new commodities. While former times knew the sale of humans, they did not yet know the sale of human body parts. Trade of an organ is often based on the assent of the poor person whose organ is to be extracted, but not always. Especially when it comes to the organs of children, international criminal organizations plan the abduction of the living donors. There's also a trade in organs from dead persons. To forcefully cut off the hair of women in order to sell is not murderous, but who could have imagined anyone getting this idea? Lately, the trade in hair has become such a lucrative international business that in several South American states, gangs have started to attack women and rob them of their hair. While it may have happened in former times that somebody tried to transport a valuable object in his or her body, the recruitment of so-called mules, i.e. men and women who carry up to 2 kilos of drugs in their bodies, has not been heard of before our times. Neither has this been the case for the sale of parts of national sovereignty. Of course, during colonial times, there have been chiefs in Africa, as well as princes in India and elsewhere, who accepted payment for making it easier to extract the riches of their people. But today, there are also numerous examples of governments whose members rob their country and take part in international criminal practices. I am not going into this, nor will I go into the decisions to grant exceptions from national law which enable the development of export processing zones, as well as of offshore financial markets and flags of convenience. Instead, I will simply point to the fact that the sale of the permit to dump toxic waste in a country or near its seashores is directly threatening the health of the fellow citizens of these government members. You probably all know that piracy started like that, the modern piracy. Again, we could enumerate quite a number of examples. One of the outstanding differences between trade relations in former times and the present are the numerous international conventions and certification practices. I am not very confident. As far as certificates are concerned, I always remember the statement of a trade union official who had been a member of an international commission to look into working conditions. He recalled that in some of the worst factories, they were shown a whole number of certificates. Certification also is a business. As far as conventions are concerned, their main value seems to consist in the fact that people fighting for better conditions can refer to them, thereby gaining political legitimation for their struggle. Alas, on the whole, actual developments have shown more and more often that market conditions overpower regulation. One of the most striking examples of this relation concerns developments in the shipping industry. At the same time when the much-praised Comprehensive Maritime Labour Convention of the International Labour Organization is going into effect, after having been ratified by the appropriate number of flag states, many seafarers experience decreasing wages and worsening working conditions because of the slump on the international market for sea transport. Without national and international critique demanding definite actions of governments, the determining force of regulation is very limited. There are exceptions. If the Dublin agreements have not been able to form reality, they have, nevertheless, had an effect on the lives of thousands of African men, women, and children endeavoring to achieve entry into Europe. More than 20,000 have died in the Mediterranean since the first Dublin Agreement went into effect in 1997. And only last week, 92 Nigerians have perished of thirst on their way to Algeria through the desert. A closer look on these migrations would not only disclose the huge business of the smuggling of humans, but also the role of international capital in producing the causes of these migrations. The fence between the USA and Mexico has had similar effects. If it has indeed decreased the number of persons trying to irregularly immigrate into the USA, it has not decreased the number of deaths, because the heavily guarded fence has led many poor people to try to cross the border through the southwest desert of Arizona. There are still between 150 and 200 deaths a year. These developments should give us pause to once more take into consideration the defining characteristics of capitalism. While there has been a general tendency to open up markets, sometimes by employing forceful persuasion, the labor markets in major metropolitan core states of capitalism have been more or less closed for immigrants in recent times. While capitalism used to be characterized by the fact that more and more people were compelled to offer their capacity to labor as a commodity, many are now prevented to do so by laws, by international agreements, and by the employment of European armed forces. Didier Avadi, a hip-hop star from Senegal, is correct in pointing out that the lives of the thousands of migrating humans are considered to be of no value whatsoever. One might debate if this means that they have even sunk below the value of those humans who used to be bought as slaves. Let me conclude by risking a hypothesis about the changing nature of trade in the history of capitalism. We have started out by looking at strategies of competition of which it would have been very difficult to differentiate them from wars. The possibility to use force in order to cheaply acquire commodities to be sold with the profit remains present. This notwithstanding, the use of arms in conducting trade has decreased with economic dominance of major capitalist powers having become securely established. Of course, in every military action in which these powers are engaged, economic interests and economic strategies are also present. but Alan Makesins-Wood is correct in stating that military force is no longer necessary to acquire the raw materials for the economies of the metropolitan core of capitalism. They can be acquired by paying the price which is demanded and or by bribing corrupt officials. In other words, the century-old marriage between trade and war seems to have lost some of its flair. This, of course, only means that market forces have become dominant, can have their own deadly effect. Nobody had to bodily threaten any one of the thousands of Indian farmers who have taken their own life in recent years. Taking up the offer of seeds from Monsanto and then feeling absolutely helpless in the face of a bad harvest in many depths was constrained enough. In other words, the structural violence of market forces has overpowered the force of weapons. Once economic dominance has been established, trade can be conducted legally and peacefully, in other words, civilized, and still remain a killing force. Thank you.